The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they
main
are
engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this very special Space Show program. On a Thursday evening, we don't typically do programs on a Thursday evening, and so it's special because of that. It is also very special because of the guest. I'll explain that in a couple of minutes. For those of you who would like to call us and talk to our very special guest tonight, Dr. Patrick Collins, who happens to be in Japan, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient. Let the phone ring. I'll bring you up on air as quickly as I most possibly can. Email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And that is another way you can reach us. And then the third way you can reach us is through our blog, which is on our website, thespaceshow.com. Again, go all the way to the far right, and you'll see upcoming shows. This is the first show listed in the upcoming show menu. Open it up. That is our archive page for this program. Scroll all the way down to the bottom, as usual. That's where comments are. And you can post your comment or your question for Dr. Collins, and I'll get it almost instantaneously. You do not have to log in to Discuss or any other program to post your comment. You can do so as a guest. But the preferred way, of course, is our toll-free phone line, 1-866-687-7223. If someone is outside the United States and you want to give us a call, you can use the toll-free line if your country where you are allows toll-free calling to the United States. So if it does, what you want to do is ask your operator in your country for the MCI local operator. And assuming you can get to the MCI local operator in your country, you give them the number, 866-687-7223. Tell them it is a San Francisco, California, Bay Area toll-free number that you would like to connect to. And they should be able to put you right through to the Space Show. But again, your country has to permit toll-free calling to the United States, and you have to have an in-country MCI operator. what else I can tell you is do go to our website in general, thespaceshow.com. So Center Right is our website newsletter, and it's very detailed for the upcoming week. You can see all the programs listed, and if you scroll down, you'll see what we have planned, and right now we're booking shows into third quarter of this year. And then everything we do is archived. You can certainly listen right off of our website or easily and quickly download the programs. In the upper left, there is another menu, and under support, you'll see our store for T-shirts, coffee mugs, things of that nature. And also there, you will see the Listen Live button in the menu. So many of you ask, how do you listen to a live show? How do you listen to an archive show? So these are the directions. Please feel free to share that information. And then center right again, or a little further to the right, is where what I consider to be the most important information, that is to support the Space Show. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, and it is your financial support, your contributions, that enable the Space Show to keep functioning and our content to be distributed for free. And, I guess the only thing I can say is I'm laying it on the line that without your support, we're not going to be here. And many of you use the Space Show to support your products that you make money on, and you never support us. I don't think that's very fair. So we do need your support, and we hope that you will support us. Remember, as a tax-free organization, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're paying California taxes, because we're a California public benefit corporation. And help keep us on the air, because honestly, without your support, we're not going to be here. And we thank those of you who do support us and those of you who will support us. So again, check us out on the website. You'll see both the Amazon link for supporting us through Amazon purchases, as well as for PayPal in support of the Space Show. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. In addition, we have corporate sponsors besides individual sponsors. Our corporate sponsors are crucial for our health and well-being, and we're very, very grateful that they are on board with us. Do click on their banner ads from time to time. They change the content behind those banner ads, and again, those sponsors are very, very important to us. We do read short sponsor messages from these guys. So let me tell you that for the first segment, again, the Space Plan is bringing you part of the first segment. This is the Integrated Space Plan. It is the detailed 100-year forecast of our future in space. The plan includes Earth to orbit, reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. And you can see all of it at their website, thespaceplan.com. If you look at it online, you can click on any of the 500 elements or cells. They open up into lots more information. You can buy the Integrated Space Plan poster. It is full-size, huge, although it's not interactive when you buy it. It's in full color. And it will inspire you, so check it out. Everything there is at thespaceplan.com. The Space Foundation is also a sponsor, and we're already talking about their upcoming 34th symposium. Their 33rd just ended, and I was there, and it was really outstanding. So the 34th symposium, it's not too early to be making plans, is April 16th through the 19th in 2018. At the Broadmoor Hotel again in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Check them out at spacesymposium.org. Great for networking, meeting all sorts of new people, learning all sorts of new things, getting a new perspective on different parts of the space community. I assure you it will be a fabulous experience for you to attend the 34th Space Symposium. And as I told you, our guest is very special because Dr. Patrick Collins is back with us from Japan. But Patrick, 16 years ago, was the very first Space Show guest ever. I recently played his program as a golden oldie when I went to Colorado for the Space Symposium. So those of you that heard that show, you're going to hear Patrick 16 years later. But more than that, Patrick helped me in many ways when I was writing my doctoral dissertation. So we go back about 20 years, and I incorporated his space tourism surveys that he did in Japan and then later on in the United States. I think Japan was 1993 and the U.S. was 1995. I incorporated his work and referenced it, of course, in my dissertation. He is a well-known and very well-respected authority on space economics, space tourism, reusable launch vehicles, and space solar power. He is a professor of economics at Azabu University in Japan and an advisor to a number of companies and organizations. His focus on research for the past 25 years has been how to stimulate growth of the commercial space activities, which are the two main opportunities being tourism and energy supply. If you read his full bio on the Space Show website, you'll see where his papers are located, and you can access them at the spacefuture.com site, but the specifics are on the website. He's very well published, very well respected, and do read his full bio, but we're going to use our time to talk with Dr. Collins. Patrick, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you, David. Very good to speak to you again. And first of all, congratulations for the Space Show surviving 16 years. I mean, that's really terrific.
Yeah, that's right. It's hard to believe it's been that long.
Right.
But
it's fascinating how the technology has changed so much. I mean, the information technology industry has just boomed and boomed. You're probably going to have a live video show quite soon, I guess.
Well, when are we going to have space tourism actually working with routine flights? I mean, we thought that was going to happen a lot sooner than 16 years.
That's right. That's the shocking thing, seeing how far the information technology industry has managed to move ahead. And space tourism, we're still waiting for suborbital flights. You know, this is really depressing.
It is really depressing. Why do you think that is? Has it been harder than the companies thought? I don't think it's been having anything to do with the regulatory regime or the regulatory environment, because that's been pretty laissez-faire for the most part. Why do you think the delays, especially after the XPRIZE, have been so long-lasting?
Right. When I say depressing, I should correct myself. I'm also extremely pleased with the progress that has been made, because there is a lot of progress as well. I mean, it's just we aren't actually flying yet. One of the sort of always big things, which I guess that we talked about 16 years ago, though I didn't hear the golden rule, is the space agencies. You know, the space agencies, around the world, they spend about $30 billion a year, or probably a bit more, and they don't do space tourism. You know, they'll do anything. They'll spend money on anything, however far in the future it is, but they won't do space tourism. And this is, a waste, you know, in terms of the potential contribution to the economy and so on. The good thing on that is that the aviation people have started, you know, with, as you say, the XPRIZE, you know, the FAA got involved. And then just 3 years ago now, the British CAA, the Civil Aviation Authority, got involved. Wrote a couple of really great reports about, very positive about the potential economic benefits from doing space tourism, and they're working on, you know, developing a spaceport now. But they also are waiting for the vehicles. They're particularly waiting for Virgin, because, of course, the Virgin, the founder, Richard Branson, is British. And so they were sort of expecting him to come and fly from Britain as well.
One of the things I noticed, Patrick, back when I met you and when I did my dissertation, in fact, I turned it in, the industry was already changing. But those changes weren't really recorded in my dissertation. But we were talking about companies that were planning single stage to orbital space tourism. We weren't talking about anybody doing suborbital tourism. When they decided that and started going into bankruptcy and having other problems, and they couldn't do single stage to orbit technically and for a lot of other reasons, and orbital tourism was way beyond their capabilities, as they found out, they did a fallback position to suborbital tourism. That wasn't even in our consciousness for those early days of space tourism. And everybody thought, well, you know, that's going to be slam dunk, because, you know, everybody can go read the history books and the tech manuals on how to do suborbital tourism. And here we are, and it's still not there as a commercial operation or even anything close to being routine.
Well, you're right that the real goal is orbital tourism, and then obviously from there to the moon and so on.
Right.
And so compared to that, suborbital is sort of trivially easy, as you should say, but disappointingly, it's taken a disappointing long time. And it would be good, you know, if there was a bunch of money where there was a whole lot of companies trying. You know, it's interesting, aviation or the car industry, there were literally hundreds of companies in the early days making little airplanes and making cars and so on. And it was the vibrant competition between them all that drove the whole thing on. And of course, the better ones lasted out and so on. And so we haven't got very many companies actually funded. There's fingers of one hand sort of thing. And they're doing great, you know, really trying hard and raising money and things. But it's not the critical mass that we really could do with.
One of the things that concerns me about the future of the suborbital industry, and you're an economist, so you're better suited than me, because I only got to flirt with economics in graduate school and my doctoral program. Businesses like to have repeat business, and making a sale to a second, third, repeat customer is a lot cheaper and easier than making a sale all the time to a brand new customer. So I asked the suborbital guys, what's your prognosis for repeat customers? I never get an answer from them, Patrick. Is this an industry that is at some point going to exhaust the first-time sale, and then it's going to be really, really hard to get a first-time buyer, and they're not going to have any repeat customers? What's your take on this? Because I think that's hard for future survival if you don't have repeat customers.
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's certainly famous about, parks like Disneyland and so on, that they have to keep repeaters coming in to keep the business going.
Absolutely.
My thought on the suborbital has been, first of all, it'll get much, much cheaper. You probably remember Bert Rutan saying he thinks it'll be as cheap as $400 a head, a suborbital flight.
Right.
Once it's like aviation, you know, you've got hundreds of vehicles flying every lots of times a day and so on. It's so unstressful compared to going to orbit and back, you know, the re-entry and so on, that vehicles could easily fly several times a day once it's routine. And even if it doesn't get to 400, even if it was only 4,000, I think everybody will fly once. And if you think about that, I think that's enough for that industry to survive while orbital vehicles are being developed. To give an example, here in Japan, every prefecture in Japan has a planetarium, and all the kids are taken to the planetarium at some point or other. And all the planetariums in the red, because we only go once to a planetarium, more or less. Well, I think that a suborbital flight will become the 21st century planetarium. So that, you know, when there's little spaceports all around the place. You see, it's a suborbital spaceport. It doesn't really need very much. It needs some fuel tanks, basically. It's not like an orbital port, which will have to have 24-hour operation and massive fuel tanks and so on. And so I think every kid will go on a suborbital flight at some point. And so that, in Japan, there's about 1 million kids born every year. Well, 1 million a year, that'll be, let's say, you know, a few billion dollars a year. And so suborbital, I don't see it growing and growing forever, but I think it could stay and reach a level where, you know, everybody takes a flight once kind of thing. And that'll be fine, I think.
And we'll get ultimately replaced by some form of orbital tourism?
Well, I think the reason why people, you know, still counting on suborbital is because it's seen as it's a really good business model for orbital, and it's much cheaper, much less risk, and if it gets going and makes money, you know, in business, as I say, you know, start small, and if you make money, we'll grow. And so at some point, if it's making money and seen as, you know, safe enough and so on, then investors say, well, let's go for orbit, and it you know, the amount of investment needed is about 10 times. And it's not as if there's a lack of ideas about how to develop orbital vehicles. I think single stage is still a bit difficult, but two-stage horizontal is perfectly straightforward. They were, you know, those fairly detailed plans how to do that in the 60s. So that I think once it's seen as working, going to orbit will just follow on, won't it?
Well, it'll probably be more challenging, but I know that one time, and I did a show with the guy out of Australia, but he ran out of money, so he didn't get to do the last parts of his survey. But he was doing a tourism study, and he was presenting it at an ISDC meeting for National Space Society in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And it was a study, and he was a real marketing researcher. He did studies for Boeing and for other companies. He was a professional survey guy, so he designed a really good study. And he was trying to see if people preferred suborbital or orbital, and if people knew that orbital was close by, would they be willing to go suborbital and spend the money, or would they bank their money and wait for orbital? And his preliminary results were that they overwhelmingly preferred orbital, and if they thought orbital was somewhat close at hand, at least within the realm of what they could tolerate given their age and health and stuff for waiting, they would wait and not spend their money on suborbital, but they would wait for the orbital opportunity. And I thought that was pretty interesting. But he didn't develop the rest of the thing because the people that were funding him didn't continue to fund his research. I could find the show in his name in my archives, and I guess I should follow up with him and see if he ever did complete the study or has he done anything new. But I remember at the time, and he was presenting it at ISDC, it was pretty shocking because people interpreted it as sort of a maybe an upper limit to what suborbital could do if the orbital industry developed. And, of course, the key was, would the orbital industry develop?
Right. Very interesting. You know, in those things, that there are the early adopters are the key guys, you know, who buy in something when it's new. And Virgin sales, they're still selling tickets, you know. And, I mean, these are the guys with lots of money and so on. And I think the appeal, you know, of going to space is still pretty strong. So that, once orbital's going, I don't think it would matter if suborbital stopped. But I don't think it will, because it'll still be so much cheaper. And quite a lot of have a go at that first sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't see orbital going down to $400, you know, a whack. I don't know that suborbital will either, but you're right. Suborbital will be significantly cheaper than going on an orbital flight.
So the orbital, I don't think it's going to go much below, let's say, $10,000. I mean, I don't know, but... suborbital, even if it's a few thousand dollars, I think a large number of people will go. You know, once it's sort of ordinary and, you know, haven't you been to space yet kind of thing, you know, sort of. And it's a very interesting question. You know, it's a famous problem about marketing that people are not good at predicting their future behavior, they say. You know, they genuinely try to think what it would be like, but when it actually happens, it's so different from what they thought and so on.
Do you have...
So it can be too...
Go ahead. I don't
want to... It can be too optimistic or too pessimistic just because... when the event arrives, you know, they're in a different phase of life and all sorts of different things happen.
Do you
tend to think that, the imagery of going to space will still just be exciting enough, you know?
Do you have a favorite pick for the suborbital company you think will be the first to go commercial and make it big time? Would you go out on a limb and say who that might be?
No, I don't. I don't have enough kind of knowledge about. And there's not that many that I think, you know, any of the ones who are trying now. The one, as you probably know, I've been friends with for a long time, is Bristol.
Bristol Space Planes, right.
And the reason for that is because their plan is unique. Their head is unique. First of all, he's in his 70s, and he, in the 1960s, he worked on space plane design, because he said that in Europe and America at that time, when the first orbital flights of people had happened and so on, he said it just became, you know, everyone said, well, obviously, we just got to make these reusable. You know, we can't go on riding missiles. And there was a lot of work on that. And then, because of the space race, it sort of all got dropped, and they just used missiles. But his whole plan is aimed at orbital vehicles. And so his suborbital vehicles and his precursor vehicles are designed on a path to reach orbital. And it's just very sad that Virgin's vehicle, it's not a design which... you can then make bigger and go to orbit in. Neither the hybrid engine nor the tailplane re-entry thing is suitable for coming in, you know, for going to orbit and back. So that's not on that path, you know. And so, if I'm advising investors, when I occasionally meet people who are potentially interested, I always recommend that as something that if it was funded, if it goes successful, could be the Boeing of space, you know.
Yeah, but you know, if you let's just look at SpaceX. If you are going to do orbital tourism in a Dragon and you have to launch with a Falcon 9 for your tourism, so even if they have reduced the launch cost significantly, you're still talking many, many, many millions of dollars to launch the Falcon 9, and the Dragon holds 6 or 7 people. Or Blue Origin, I don't know what their launch price is going to be for their bigger rocket, but I saw their capsule at the Space Foundation. It holds 7 people. You know, it's really cool, but you know, you're going to have a launch to orbit still in the multiple of millions, even if the price comes down. That's an expensive trip.
Yes, right. I think. So in the future, there will be both vertical takeoff and horizontal takeoff vehicles, just because they have, you know, they both have advantages for certain activities. But I don't know if the current vehicles, are, you know, I'm not at all close to design, are really very suitable. Dragon, you know, famous Elon Musk has said he's not interested in tourism. He wants to send people to Mars, which immediately changes your viewpoint, and as, you know, vehicle design and stuff. If you're designing to carry people up and down to orbit as much as possible, you know, you design in a particular way, but if you're trying to send rather smaller numbers of people to Mars, it's a very different objective altogether. So I'm a bit disappointed with that.
Go ahead.
Oh, and just for the vertical, for Blue Origin, well, they're working on suborbital at the moment, aren't they? And they have the capsule coming back by parachute, aren't they, with passengers in. And, you know, I don't think that's a really a very... long-term sort of thing that can work on a big scale. Parachuting is statistically, it's much more dangerous than landing with wheels and wings.
But it's easier to do and less mass. So it serves a purpose for these for the earlier stage development process. But, yeah, I think eventually they'll have to evolve into something a little different.
Right. And this is where, you know, the companies which are doing this, I mean, I take my hat off to them. I support them all wholeheartedly. But they don't. The money they use is in total is a fraction of what the space agencies have. You know, so if they had even if there was a billion a year spread around these companies, I think they'd just be much. You know, they'd be able to try many more different things and have more teams trying different approaches to different problems and stuff, and they would all just move forward more quickly. You know, with people different approaches being. Which succeed and so on.
Yeah, but of course the space agencies are doing interplanetary missions and science missions and, you know, the space station with all their partnerships. And so they're doing a lot more things with the money. But I know NASA is not chartered to do anything commercial.
Well, yes and no. You remember the famous phrase that Tom Rogers used to quote everywhere, that NASA, the law, which was rewritten in 85, I think it was, wasn't it, the commercial space thing. One of the phrases in the law is that NASA is required by law to seek and encourage to the maximum extent possible the fullest commercial use of space.
But they, as a government agency, can't do it. So that's what they're doing by working with public-private partnerships and by supporting commercial companies that are doing private space. But NASA itself is not going to do a commercial project under NASA itself. So
absolutely. It's not their job to do operate tourism or anything like that. But they could easily interpret that to say we've got to develop reusable passenger carrying vehicles. That's certainly, I would say, undoubtedly the most promising commercial use of space.
Well, you know, if some company came to them with a plan for a public-private partnership to develop reusable commercial suborbital launchers or something like that, they might be able to get funded by NASA. Nobody's come to them with something like that. So
or even an orbital vehicle, you know, because that's where you need billions. They've got plenty of billions. I mean, there's lots of sort of examples where governments, you know, develop a vehicle and then sort of auction it off to companies who want to operate. You know, in Concorde is the obvious example.
Well, but no one would take the auction if they wanted to auction off SLS because the operating costs would be so high that no commercial company could do it.
That's right. It's not designed with that in mind.
Yeah.
It's not designed with the intention of having it over.
You have a space tourism question from Carl in Salt Lake City, and he says, Patrick, do you consider a trip to the moon or a trip to Mars as a space tourism voyage, or is it something more, maybe a space settlement voyage? Is space tourism up and down or orbiting in LEO, or could it also include going to the moon or going to Mars or doing something else?
Well, that's a great question. Thanks very much. I see space tourism having three phases, suborbital, orbital, and then lunar. And suborbital, as I just said, you know, Bert Rutan said it could easily get less than $1,000 a head, you know, and that could really start quite soon. And I think suborbital will become quite a big business in the 2020. And if that goes reasonably, then orbital vehicles should start operating in the 30s. So we'll have a great boom of, once it's, you know, routine, orbital travel to orbit. And in orbit, we'll have whole orbits full of hotels, you know, and you probably know some of those, but orbital sports. I mean, zero-gravity sports, I guess, it's going to be such fun. You know, zero-gravity swimming pools and zero-gravity sports Olympics and stuff. It could just become massive. And one of the things you get, I think, is in the orbit around the equator. Because the equator, equatorial orbit, is unique. You can go up and down and come back to where you launched from an hour and a half later. So you'll have all these sports stadiums in orbit around the equator. And this could be a terrific popular business. I mean, sports is such a popular business anyway. And then, you know, the famous phrase, going to orbit, you're halfway to anywhere.
Right.
Well, the moon is a great tourist destination because it takes 3 days to get there, 3 days to come back. So a two-week trip, 10-day trip would just be just really great for travel agencies. You know, 2 weeks is a very good thing. And the moon, of course, has a fantastic reasons for people want to go and visit it, for sightseeing and stuff. But also the famous thing, you know, Robert Heinlein's famous short story, The Menace from Earth, about flying. You know, you can put on wings and fly there. So you just build a great big stadium and have Lunar Flying Olympic. Well, boy, everybody's going to want to do that, I think. So I think the three stages of tourism that I envisage as being really seriously important are in the suborbital during the 20s, orbital during the 30s, and it'll just go on growing and growing like aviation does, civil aviation does. And then the moon, I think in the 40s, we could easily see lunar tourism starting in the 40s. And I don't see why it would ever stop growing, just like aviation. We're up to 3 billion people a year now flying on aircraft. And I think it'll just grow and grow so that, you know, everyone can do that. Mars is totally different, you see, because it takes a year to get there. Well, you know, in the future, maybe we'll use nuclear rockets and cut that right down. But until it's made much shorter, you know, even very rich people, they're taking 2 years off. It's not really a business proposition, I don't think. But, you know, maybe emigration there will become popular. And then you get into, you know, maybe terraforming and so on. The usual story about terraforming is it takes, you know, like 100 years or something. Well, that's not a very good idea. But I suspect they'll find out ways of making it much, 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 much quicker, you know, with 3D printing machines that replicate and so on. So I wouldn't like to say Mars tourism is impossible, but I don't think it's really a serious thing for businesses to think about in the near future, whereas orbital tourism, I mean, just designing space hotels is going to be just one of the most fun bits of engineering you can imagine. Imagine designing a space stadium where you can have 3D football or something like that. And yeah, it's just really fun subject, you know.
Here's another email question for you and listeners. I hope we're going to use the phone tonight. We're not going to do everything by email.
That's okay.
Cindy's in Las Vegas, and she says, Dr. Collins, there aren't very many human medical factor issues or complexities for suborbital. There are a few for orbital, but once you get beyond low Earth orbit and you go into real space, the moon or further or something like that, there are all sorts of human medical complexities, and they are not, as of today, resolved. We don't even have closed-loop life support systems. So my question is, if you're forecasting the moon in the 40s and orbital in the 30s, do you foresee actually solving human medical factor complex issues? Will we have mitigation strategies or cures? Or what will we do? Surely you have to factor in, will humans be able to take the trips? How will they fare? Will their health be okay? Are they going to die on the way? What's going to happen to them? Plus our environmental systems that we don't have yet. How does this impact your timeline idea?
Well, thanks again. That's a really great question as well. My timeline, it's not exactly I'm forecasting that. What I'm saying is that is technically possible. If companies and or governments around the world say, let's do this, and stick in, we need a few hundred million, or maybe, let's say a few billion a year to carry on. If we had a few billion a year in a plan to follow this path, you know, the three phases of space tourism, I think all of those problems are solvable. Now, I can't say they're all, you know, like, trivially easy to solve. I don't mean that at all. But radiation, for example, is, you know, one of the biggest issues of going to the moon and so on. You know, we know a lot about radiation, and the people who live on the moon, like the people who run the hotels or the dome cities, you know, and the stadiums and stuff, there's going to be quite a big population. They obviously have to spend quite a lot of their time below ground, you know, like where their living quarters are, as we understand at the moment. But for tourists, it's quite interesting. You know, they can go there and have a week on the surface and come back, and except for a solar flare or something, that's fine. You know, none of the astronauts who went to the moon and back have died of radiation poisoning or something. So I think that for tourism, that's quite a good. The other thing is, you remember, with the low gravity on the moon, so you can fly, you can also build very tall buildings. And so, you know, they're going to build dome cities eventually, where the dome is, let's say, a kilometer high and several kilometers wide. And you're going to have buildings inside which are 400 stories or 600 stories. And, you know, they're made of concrete and so on. So actually, inside the building, not much radiation will get to you inside the building. So, you know, if you're walking out on the surface in a spacesuit to look at the sights or something, or in the glass dome, you know, flying sports or something, obviously there'd be quite a bit of radiation. But for people who are just going for a week or so, I don't think that's a real problem. And the other thing, of course, radiation medicine, you know, is progressing all the time. And I don't know, chelation, is it? Is it chelation, the kind of thing, or a way of taking out radiation from your body? I'm sure they'll get better at, you know, making it radiation resistant. So then the closed life support. Yeah, there's plenty of engineering still to be done, I agree. But, you know, the human race is brilliant at engineering. We're getting better and better all the time. But what I'm most frustrated about is just that we're not doing it. Why isn't there a big project to develop fully enclosed life support systems? I've got a book here called Lunar Utilization, published in 1976, which is just a huge conference of lots of people, you know, designing engineering systems on the moon, how to extract aluminium and water from the rocks and this kind of thing. This was 40 years ago, and there's already a huge amount of knowledge about how to do it, but just no one said, let's do it. So the good news there is, you know, India and China and Russia have all talked about setting up moon bases soon, you know. Well, that'll be great. That'll start to irritate some Americans, I guess. Hey, why aren't we doing it too? You know, brush off these old books and just get on and do it. And so, you know, I can't foresee how all the different problems are solved. But I do have a lot of confidence that, you know, if we spend a few billion dollars a year on these things, that, you know, they're amenable to solution, you know.
More money would certainly help, but do you think more money is the big issue, or is something else an issue?
Well, yeah, I do think it's the money, really. Just because I get, you know, I see these space agencies spending these huge amounts of money. And my main sort of focus is economics. And I've been very struck recently thinking about, you know, the world economy is a very poor state, you know, the America, Europe, and Japan together. We're missing about 50 million jobs. And the reason for that is, the older industries, you know, they get more and more efficient and use less in the field. But we've also moved a lot of them, as you know, offshore, moved them to countries whose costs are much lower and so on. And so then the question is, what are we doing? You know, what shall we do? And this is this very high unemployment, about 50 million jobs missing. And you look at the history of transportation systems, and if you just take the main ones, horse carriages, and then sailing ships, and then a railway, you've got canals as well, but railways, and then steamships, and then cars, and then aircraft. Each of those transportation systems became a gigantic industry which spread throughout the entire world and employed like millions and millions of people. And now, you know, cars and aircraft employ each about 100 million people. They create, not directly, but indirectly as well, jobs like that. But, you know, even horse carriages for hundreds of years employed literally tens of millions of people around the world in all sorts of related industries. And so then you say, well, the weird thing is that rocket propulsion isn't doing that yet. Rocket propulsion this year is the 75th anniversary of the first rocket flight to space on the 3rd of October, 1942. And the engineers who did that, you know, they had a party that evening, or they had huge, all the engineers had parties, and said, great, today we've proved we can have space travel, you know, when the war's over. They were developing missiles. But they all knew missiles meant space travel, and so they drank toast to space travel. And, you know, here we are 75 years later, we still haven't done it. And, you know, it's very strange in the history of technology. When new technology is invented, people, you know, start using it in many ways as they can and sell services to the public as much as they can. And that's what we see with the Internet, is endless explosion of brilliant developments from the Internet. But rockets haven't been used for that yet. It's kind of starvation in the midst of plenty. Allowing space travel to grow as far as air travel would create, as I say, tens of millions of jobs. Or at least as far as I can see.
I think most people would agree with you, but you don't ever hear the politicians talk about developing a space economy. And I've been harping about Trump. He's got this plan to rebuild American infrastructure, which I don't think any sane person would deny is in great need. And I keep saying, why not dedicate a part of whatever you're going to spend on American infrastructure and start building needed space infrastructure. But that's not in the mix.
Excellent idea.
But that's not in the mix. But it's not in the mix either. So you don't hear this from the people who tax us to death and then decide how to spend our tax money.
No, that's absolutely right. It's just the same here. The government here spends about It's about $60 billion a year on public works every year, and that creates several million jobs in the construction industry. And so me and some of the guys and some of the, you know, the organizations who are trying to get space tourism to happen are planning to propose a little, you know, just a teeny part of that budget, you know, out of $50 billion, just a teeny bit, to start studying space infrastructure, as you say, so spaceports and then, you know, orbital infrastructure and so on. But why not, you know, 21st century infrastructure? That's going to create far more jobs than, you know, improving bridges and so on. And in Japan, as I say, there's a big lack of new jobs. But I suppose it's just policy. It's inevitable for politicians to focus on, you know, the big industries that exist today. So Japan's car industry is a great success. It's terrific. You know, they're brilliant at making cars. And they make more and more cars every year and sell them more and more around the world. But they employ fewer and fewer people in Japan every year because it's, you know, it's past the peak now. It's robotization and stuff. So there's no way that the car industry is going to create 5 million jobs in Japan, which is what they need.
You know,
they have to look ahead, yeah.
We've been doing a series of programs with a couple of people about what the guests call fourth industrial revolution manufacturing capabilities,
right.
And in-house space is a recipient of that. So you talk about AI and robotics and 3D printing and additive manufacturing, and the industry is being developed with that already. It's not as if old timers are being thrown out. It's that the new companies are already adopting this and using this. So they do employ fewer people, but their capabilities are poised to really expand. And if there was commercial industrial development for space, it would probably heavily lean on new manufacturing techniques, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, robotics. It wouldn't be as labor intensive, but I believe, I don't have any statistics to back it up, that it would be a huge wealth creating industry.
Yeah, I agree totally. When I saw recently how 3D printing has just suddenly really reached a tipping point, it seems, and how it's really brilliantly appropriate for space use in space, I kind of have this vision that for various reasons this new technology of basic space travel has been blocked for 75 years. Now, having said that, of course, they've developed lots of technological capabilities, like brilliant rocket engines and brilliant, you know, vacuum technology and so on, but they haven't applied it to the one service, which is for the general public, which will really create a big market. And so what's happened is just the way, you know, things go is that people have developed all these other related technologies, which eventually this blockage is going to blow, and we're going to have this explosive growth into space because, as you say, it makes, for example, I was talking about, you know, sports stadiums. I can't see any reason why we won't have sports stadiums in orbit. And 3D printing is just perfect for making these all sorts of complex shapes and structures and things in huge quantities. I mean, like, and you know, where you have self-replicating machines and so on. So I think it's going to be it's very delayed takeoff, but once the takeoff starts, it's going to be much quicker than it could, that people probably imagine.
Well, I just would like to see it kick in, and I really think it would be an economic boon to not just the countries that were undertaking this development and this economic infrastructure, but I also am one of these idealists, Patrick, where I really think the path for a better world and for more prosperity, this is my Kool-Aid here, you know, my Kool-Aid fantasy vision. The path through a better economy and a better world and more harmony in the world happens to go through outer space. And I really do believe that, and I hope I live long enough to see that actually happen and that vision or idea of mine to be borne out. I don't know that I will, because the politicians are really, really bad. And
I agree totally
on
that.
Space
Renaissance International, the organization.
Right.
Led by Adriano Ortino. I mean, he's a real visionary on exactly that point, and he's written a whole lot of stuff, and yeah, I worked with him on this. That the human race needs the space renaissance, as he says. You know, we've got stuck in this kind of very low growth and, you know, poor situation, particularly in the rich countries who have all the technological knowledge. And if we just turn our attention to this field, it can certainly grow, you know, to a huge scale. I don't see how anyone can really argue that it can't, you know. Without that, you know, we're stuck with resource wars. You know, these endless wars by the rich countries against the poor countries. I mean, it's insanity. But it's one of the reasons for it, you know, is the weapons industry. You know, around the world, weapons industry is about $2 trillion a year. I mean, it's just gigantic. And so even if a politician wanted to reduce that, you know, it's almost impossible because they'd say, well, look, you know, make 10 million people unemployed. And so how do we wean countries off making weapons, which, of course, aerospace technology is a very large part of this, you know, bombers and fighter jets and missiles and so on. Well, space tourism seems to me the absolute perfect alternative because it uses aerospace technology. I mean, it's literally the same companies can just, you know, gradually make less weapons and make more orbiting gymnasiums or lunar hotels and this kind of stuff. So that I think there's a political path where we get away from this. It's really stressful situation now with, you know, all the rich countries. Well, I say all the rich countries, mostly America and Britain, you know. We're the troublemakers who endlessly bombing poor countries for whatever reason. And, you know, even with, as you said, President Trump, from what he said, from his career, I don't think he's a warmonger. I mean, he's never shown any interest in war. I think he wants to build hotels around the world. But, you know, once he's become president, I think they've hammered into him. Look, in America, $600 billion a year is then spent on the military. Now, you could cut that by three quarters, and America would still be perfectly safe. But how do you do that? How can you cut $450 billion of business and not have the economy just drive into a slump, quite apart from whether it's moral or not?
Well, I don't know, but if you talk to the defense budget experts, which I am certainly not one of them, they would certainly argue until the end of time that you couldn't cut by 50% and we would still be safe. But I'll tell you, when you see, and this is for probably every government, but when you see how they waste money and what they do and what they spend money on and cost overruns and just all of this, you know, that there is so much trashy money being thrown around. It's unbelievable. And of course, the bigger the budgets, the more money gets thrown around, and they don't have as much of an incentive to be tight. So in a way, it's kind of self-fulfilling. But I don't think we're going to reform the world. I would just like to see some intelligence in how, you know, money is spent. But, you know, since this is really the focus of the space show, I'd like to see us do more with our national space budget, and I would like to see the companies meet their challenges with better efficiency and better on-time performance and stuff like that. It's mind-boggling to me that they have so many delays and slips and all sorts of problems. I mean, you know, we were sort of joking before the show started. You know, SpaceX is delayed on so many things, including Falcon Heavy, just like SLS, in a sense, you know, that they can't do anything on time. The government can't and the private companies can't. So it's very frustrating that maybe it's just that the job, Patrick, the task is so hard. And we, you know, when a Falcon 9 flies or when the space shuttle flew and it worked perfectly, it really looked easy. And it was beautiful to see it, you know, happen, or an Atlas V, you know, for that matter.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
making it do that every single time, especially from scratch, is not probably very easy to do.
Right. Well, you've raised several points there. The first one, just to come back on, is I'm not advocating cutting the military budget and do space tourism. What I'm just responding to is your point about if we don't start seriously expanding into space quite soon, things are going to get seriously hard on the Earth. And I think that's true, because, as I say, resource wars and just the way big countries and little countries and so on. I mean, there's all this tension for no very obvious reason. I just think it's kind of unavoidable. But once, if we expand out into space and so on, and big business, it becomes big business. So there are big businesses saying, hey, you know, you can't do that because you're upset all our customers. Then it'll balance out and, you know, it'll keep growing and growing, and it'll unwind the pressure to keep, you know, military budgets up for employment reasons. And there's a relatively high unemployment in America, Europe, and Japan, put great pressures on governments, you know. And government, companies can get away with saying, oh, well, if you don't fund us for this, you know, it'll create unemployment. I mean, you know, the way Britain and America are arming Saudi Arabia to destroy Yemen. They've been bombing Yemen for 2 years now. And Britain and America, monthly, sending out missiles and, you know, aircraft and training and all of that thing. It's absolutely, totally immoral. It's totally illegal by everything. And yet they keep doing it because you can perfectly see, well, they make tons of money out of it. Well, once, if we didn't have high unemployment, if the economies were in a good state, they would, governments wouldn't be so weak against that argument. They'd say, well, no, we can't do that. You know, if you have to sack a few people, so what? And so I did in the longer term as a way of sort of reducing the pressure to have a weapons industry.
You know,
just as a figure, when you were saying about you don't think we could cut the American defense budget, it's very interesting. The American defense budget is $600 billion a year.
Oh,
and that's
it's
as much as the next 14 countries in the whole world. So it's no threat to America, whatever, you know, that requires a $600 billion budget. But anyway, let's jump ahead of that. When you think how difficult it is, you know, how difficult is it? Again, it's launch vehicles today are expendable. And when you're doing an expendable vehicle, it's very difficult to get high reliability just because it's the first flight. There was a guy from Boeing a while back who said something like, if every Boeing aircraft on its first flight had to fly from Seattle to Paris, he said half of them would fall in the sea, he said. Is this because you've got this very complicated machine with lots and lots of parts? And to get it absolutely perfect is very difficult. But, of course, aircraft are reusable. Before they throw away a Boeing 777, it flies, what, 30, 40,000 times. So, well, because it's reusable, the reliability just goes up and up and up, you know, based on statistics. That, you know, and the car industry, the aircraft industry, all of the industries know that whole system so well, reliability engineering, and every failure you get, you analyze it, why it happened, and you make a new database and all that sort of stuff. So that once you're doing pretty reusable vehicles, it just gets better and better and better. And, you know, I've been very struck with the aircraft in the aviation industry recently with these low-cost carriers. You know, how they keep cutting costs. I sometimes go to Malaysia from research I do there, and it used to be about $1,000, and it's now $500 to go there on a return trip. I mean, cutting costs by 50% just through putting their minds to it. That's what you get from reusability, I think. And so when you say, you know, it's very impressive watching a rocket take off, it is, and it's great. But it's very, very old technology. It's 75 years old this year. And now, you know, Iran and Korea and Brazil all launch satellites. You know, it's not fundamentally difficult engineering, like, say, you know, nuclear fusion or something.
Here, I've got another question for you. You ready? This is an economic one for you. So this is Dr. Doug in Southern California. And listeners, remember, phone calls are really cool and preferable, and Patrick would love to hear from you. 1-866-687-7223. So Dr. Doug in Southern California says, playing the devil's advocate here, space tourism will cause the cruise line industry to lose jobs. Therefore, the number of jobs will remain the same. Your thoughts, please.
Well, that's a good question as well. I mean, this is where, you know, economics is not a very exact science at all, you know. And that sounds like, you know, any new job you create, well, you destroy some other job, you know. Like the internet is destroying bookshops, you know, and destroying retail chains and stuff. And there is a good deal of that in the way the economy works. There's that famous phrase, isn't there, by Schumpeter called capitalist development, is a gale of creative destruction. You know, a new thing comes along and it destroys other businesses.
Of course.
But if it's good and better than before, then it still makes the economy grow. And when if you think of customers, they've got a certain amount of money to spend on holidays. Okay, we go to space this year, so we won't go on the cruise line. Sure, that's part of what will happen. But I don't think you can say, therefore, cruise lines will all go bust and there won't be any new jobs. I mean, there are many more people working in jobs around the world today than there were 100 years ago or 200 years ago.
No, I think the cruise industry will invent new ways to be competitive, and I also think they will really, really big time go into artificial intelligence and robotics and advanced crews and stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if you didn't see robots taking over some of the crewed positions on a cruise liner down the road to cut labor out of it.
That's right. And even I think cruise lines have a guaranteed future, because just traveling around the world and visiting nice places is really, really interesting. You know, visiting Egypt or visiting the North Pole. Or, I mean, cruise lines don't go to the North Pole, but you know what I mean, going to different places.
Well, you can go to Alaska on a cruise liner, so you can, and then go overland, I guess. But
yeah.
No, I just think they'll find ways to do it a lot more efficient and things like that. But the great part about most of space to me is you don't have a lot of legacy, crappy, labor-intensive hardware that you have to deal with or lay people off with or modernize. You get to develop new cutting-edge stuff for the most part. And
that's a
real plus for economic development down the road. And as far as putting businesses out of business, I mean, that's been our history. The buggy whip makers went out of business, and I'm sure that was very painful back in the day to people who made buggy whips, or remember lamplighters, you know, that would walk the streets of London and New York and turn lights on and off, you know, because there was no electricity. And, you know, on and on and on. These jobs have all been put out of business. And over time, the economies have grown, and there have been more opportunities for the people than fewer opportunities as a result of these changes. But I think we're in a brave new world with artificial intelligence and robotics and 3D printing. And I don't think anybody knows where this is going to end up. I mean, you know, you probably have heard in Japan where some countries are talking about giving people guaranteed incomes because they're not going to have jobs anymore because of...
That's a very serious issue now. Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
That. Because, you know, if you just... I mean, it's sort of a science fiction coming true, as it were, but if you just visualize a world where basically everything's made by machines, no one has to work, well, there are novels about how a society like that runs. And the basic income, I think, is something that's going to come along. There's several experiments this year. There's one in Toronto, some in Finland, some in Holland or something.
And Eastern Europe has some, too. And I know Oakland, California is toying with the idea, but they have no money to give anybody anything. So
I
don't know what Oakland would do.
The full implementation, you basically scrap everything else. You scrap, you know, health insurance or employment insurance and
the benefit packages,
In favor of the system. And, you know, it starts off small and builds up. And it obviously raises all sorts of problems. But we are in a world where the amount of work that has to be done is just dropping like a stone now. And this is where governments are very weak, I think, in facing that this is a brave new world. I mean, it's just different. And if we're not careful, it's kind of heaven or hell. You know, if we allow the unemployed to get more and more and more, you're going to end up with a few tiny elite bosses at the top and a whole country full of slaves. And they won't be able to buy the products of the factories, so the whole thing just collapses. But if you have something like basic income and so on, you can see a way in which everyone is able to spend more of their time doing more of what they want to do. You know, and people who do all sorts of things, you know, just all sorts of projects that they like, they want to do, they've always wanted to do, they never could do and stuff. You know, a really, really great future. But in the meantime, this unemployment, I say it's the lack of new industry. The whole of economic history, the productivity improving, so you don't need so many people. For example, in farming. In farming now, 3% of the people make food for everybody. But 97% of people aren't unemployed. They all do other things. But what's happened is we've had this very rapid improvement in productivity, and we've also shifted all these industries to other countries. And temporarily, there's a lack of new industries. And I think one key one is the whole of space, because as I said, if that would just be as big as civil aviation, that's tens of millions of jobs involving a lot of high technology and marketing skills, which is exactly what we have. And as you said, and something like basic income coming along to stabilize the whole thing, I think that's the correct direction we're heading in.
Patrick, we're at the top of the hour. I'm going to take our break right now. But when we come back, let's take a look at potential economics of rocket reusability, like SpaceX is doing, Blue Origin is doing. United Launch Associates has a different model. Is it going to be all that it's cracked up to be, or do we need a lot more data before we know that? So let's talk about reusability with launch vehicles.
Correct.
When we come back. Everybody, stay where you are. Back in 3 minutes. And we do answer the phone during the break if anybody wants to call us. 1-866-687-7223. And email remains drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Back in three, everyone.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. Advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our special Thursday night Space Show program, and our guest is with us from Japan, Dr. Patrick Collins. We do have a couple of sponsors that have brought us tonight's second segment of the program. So we thank Orbital ATK, which is a global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and they're known as a partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. We also thank the AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, which is the world's largest aerospace professional society, and they have over 30,000 individual members from 88 countries with 95 corporate members. They're very busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, and increasing our knowledge of the universe, bringing the world closer together. Check them out at their website at AIAA.org. And then we have Celestis, which is the premier global leader in providing Memorial spaceflight services. They've been doing this since 1995, and they have the DNA service that we've been talking about. And briefly, what this means is that you can send your loved ones who's passed away DNA to space if you're doing, say, a traditional funeral for your loved one. And you can also mix your own DNA with your loved one, so the two of you can fly to space together. And then usually these orbital flights, unless you're going to the moon or another destination, will eventually come back and burn up in the atmosphere as part of the energy of the cosmos, and you can be with your loved ones. So this is their new DNA service, and you can get a lot more information on it at Celestis.com. So check it out. It's a great way to both honor and memorialize your loved one who has passed away, and to join with them. I mean, normally you can't do that. So they've come up with a way to do that. Patrick Collins is with us, Dr. Patrick Collins. Patrick, there's not a lot of information yet on the economics of reusability. There's a lot of speculation. A lot of statements have been made by SpaceX people and Elon Musk, but we don't have hard data as if we've been doing reusable first stages, say, for 2 or 3 or 4 years and actually flying many of them per year. But how do you see this? Is it going to dramatically lower launch costs, marginally lower them? Is a company going to be willing to fly on the fourth use of a used first stage? What will those insurance rates look like? Or the fifth flight of one? Maybe they'll do it on the second, but then I would think the risk would go up for each one, and their satellites are pretty costly investments. So is the opportunity cost if the thing hits the drink. So how do you see it all?
Yeah, well, you've covered a lot of points there, and they're good points. I sort of tend to think that it'll just, once reusable rockets are being used, and the reuses, the number of reuses increases enough, then the whole process of collecting statistics and, you know, making maintenance schedules and stuff will just continue and continue and get better and better and better. Really like the aviation industry. A guy who's done some very interesting work on this is Jay Penn. I don't know if you've...
Yeah, Jay, I've lost track with Jay, but he was a big help for me during my dissertation. I know Jay, but I've lost track of him. He's still at the Aerospace Corporation?
Well, I haven't seen him for 2 or 3 years, but he was still there when I last saw him, and he did a really good report about exactly, you know, step by step, what happens when you design a vehicle to be reusable. And he said the thing about current ones is it's expendable, and you've got the whole problem. You've got a mass of fuel, and you're trying to make the payload as big as possible. So
right.
He said you make everything as light as possible so that it, you know, just survives on flight, and then you're there. He said, and you're going to do reusable, it's got to be more robust. As you were just saying, you know, the fourth flight of this fuel tank. But he said, engineers know how to make things robust. You make the metal a bit thicker and the bearings a bit bigger and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And it makes it a bit heavier, but you get a longer life. And he's got these great graphs showing exactly that. How to improve life and reliability by making it heavier, basically, in the early state, in the design process. And then it's more expensive to begin with, but it pays off later because you get a long life. And I mentioned earlier, you know, aircraft today, they fly, it's something like 40,000 flights, you know, before they have to be thrown away, you know, and they're thrown away typically because the cracks in the wing roots are getting long enough that they're getting dangerous. But it's just, I'm always struck, there's so much information about, you know, so much engineering information nowadays, and, you know, how to check the crack growth in the wing roots and that sort of stuff, all the technology and the knowledge. That I just want to have a big bunch of money and turn these guys loose. I just say, you know, I want you to build reusable launchers to orbit and just let them do it. And you want enough money that there are several teams, you know, working hard on it. And you were right earlier about, you know, it's not only the money, in the sense if you give people too much money, then they get kind of lazy and don't do the best designs. But it's just, to my mind, it's crazy that there is, as I understand it, around the whole world today, and the whole world is, you know, like trillions and trillions of dollars of business going on. There is no serious systematic effort to design and build orbital passenger vehicles today, you know, reusable orbital passenger vehicles. And, you know, if we had $1 billion a year on that, I mean, it's nothing. It's nothing in Japan. It wouldn't be anything for any country, really, you know, big, rich, of the rich countries. And yet it's not being done. It's just, you know, it's just terrible waste of time, as far as I can see.
Well, if we, one of the things that you were interested in early on, and I recall you wanted to do a demonstration space solar power project. Was it in the center or the internal parts of India or South America someplace? You wanted to set up an SSB
around the equator.
Around the equator. And what happened to that? Were you ever able to do that?
Well, it's very interesting. It's within the space agency here in Japan. At that time, there were three separate space research organizations, and I worked in each one of them. And it was called, originally called SPF 2000, the solar power
satellite. That's right, yeah.
Go in low orbit around the equator. And, yeah, I had a really fun job with another Japanese guy. We went to visit most of the equatorial countries looking for a site. We needed about a square kilometer where we could put this wire mesh to receive the energy. And in the current space plan in Japan, there is a statement about building solar power satellites. And there's a kind of what they call a roadmap with a 1 gigawatt solar power satellite in 2030. But it's lacking a real influential guy behind it. And so there's been a sort of running battle in the space agency for years now between those who want to make a separate satellite, the first demonstrator, just a small satellite to demonstrate power delivery from orbit to the ground, to do it from a satellite or do it from the space station. And I'm on the satellite side, not the space station side. And the guy who he's died now, a guy called Professor Nagatomo, a really great guy. And he just said to the people, he said, because he designed the Japanese module on the space station, so he knows all about the situation of the space station. And he said, you can't do it on the space station. They will not allow you to transmit even several kilowatts of microwave power from the space station to the ground because they're paranoid about safety and so on. And it's very difficult to prevent the microwaves, you know, getting into some system or something. And they said, no, we can do it, And so the effort to develop a demonstrator, the first step, has been completely dissipated. And so neither has succeeded. There's still a project for to build a small satellite, just a few kilowatts, from orbit to the ground. And there's still a project to do on the space station, and they can't do it on the space station. I'm convinced by that argument. So it's been just a kind of a waste of time, really. I don't know if they will in the near future. you know, the price of oil has come right back down again.
Right.
And the oil industry, you know, it's a giant industry, and it spends a huge amounts of money on technological development, and they've just developed a whole lot of technology that there's people saying, you know, we're never going to run out of oil. There's just loads of oil, and the technology gets better and better. And you may have heard the theory of abiotic oil. It's still not very well known, but in Russia, the geologists have never used the word fossil fuel, as I understand. They've never believed it was anything to do with trees or forests. It's a mineral that comes out from the inside of the Earth. From their analysis of how planets are formed, they say if you do the chemical equation, methane continually leaks out from the center of the Earth. And as it leaks out, in some places it gets blocked by places and you get a gas field, and then the blocked gas gets compressed, you know, because of geological movements and turns to oil and so on. And, yeah, I'm not a geologist, but that idea apparently is getting more and more credence. And have you seen the photos of oil on Mars?
No, I actually have not.
If you look on the web, you soon find the photos of oil on Mars. And this is on the mountainside with this great brown liquid that's obviously poured down the side of the hillside. And then there's some photos of all around the Earth. There are places where oil comes out of the ground, crude oil comes out of the ground. And there are ones where it flows down the mountainside. It's exactly like that. And then the third famous thing is the on Titan, you know, the planet Titan.
Right.
Or is it a satellite? There are seas of ethane, liquid ethane and methane. So you don't have to have, no one believes forests ever were on Titan. So there's this apparently growing spread inside of what they call abiotic oil, abiotic gas, that we're not going to run out. And it's, you know, then you get to the stories that the Iraq war is to keep the price up and this sort of thing. Of course, I don't know, but I think the argument, oh, we really need to build solar power satellites because I don't think it's got the power it used to have anymore. The technology is incredibly useful and will be very important for space development. But, we're running out of energy. We must develop solar power satellites. I think that's had its day, I'm afraid.
So you're not a big fan of space solar power like you used to be?
Not as an energy source for Earth, but I'm a big fan of the technology for several reasons. Well, one is I think it would be very good for energy on the lunar surface, you know, because you have this problem with a two-week night where everything goes to minus 300 degrees or something.
Right.
I think from orbit to the lunar surface, I suspect solar power satellites would be rather good. I think it's essential for building all these sort of hotels and things and just, you know, engineering in orbit. Solar power seems to be the obvious source, and then microwave transmission is very, very useful as well. So it's very important, key technology for space industrialization, I think. And then the other one is, you may know that the number of sunspots is at a 200-year low. And the astronomers have known about sunspot cycles for ages now, several hundred years. And when the sunspot, when there are a few sunspots, the world gets colder, and when there are more, it gets warmer. And there's pretty serious agreement among a lot of physicists and cosmologists and planetologists and this sort of thing that we're in for a, what they call a mini ice age. And for the next, the various estimates vary between 10, 30 or 100 years. And things are going to get colder. And you probably know in the States you've had a terrible winter this year, a huge, long, snowy winter still going on in plenty of places.
Yeah, but we're still seeing all the stats that they're putting out about how the everybody is warming up and climate change is heating up everything and global warming is here.
Right, that's what the media says. But
well,
if you look into the data, it just isn't.
No, I agree with you. There is a political fix on this. This is about the probably the worst scientific topic that you could ever get because the U.S. government and Western European governments have become the Catholic Church of the 1500s and the 1600s with science, and that they really control who gets money for research, what gets printed, what the media says. I mean, it is...
Yeah, that's a good analogy there.
I think we're the Catholic Church of the time period of Galileo.
Something like that.
Yeah, and...
But the funny thing is that the solar power technology... If you beam microwave down from space to the ground, you can melt the snow. And so I was at a conference just a couple of years ago here in Japan where a very senior Chinese professor, Professor Ge Changchun, his name is, he said, keep getting these sudden heavy snowstorms in the northeast of China where you suddenly get like 2 meters of snow. And he said, if you guys could beam down some microwaves and melt it, that would be really good. And we get the same in Japan now. They call them gorilla snowstorms. Suddenly get like 2 meters. And if there was a satellite you could call up and say, hey, can you come and melt this area here? This would be, a really useful application of the same technology. And it's much cheaper than providing electricity supply because you don't need the receiver on the ground. You just beam the microwave. It warms it up. So I'm very keen on that. I call it SMS, snow melting satellites.
Snow melting satellites.
Yeah, SMS.
That would be cool, although they'd probably say you can't beam it back because that's a space weapon. So, you'd probably...
Yeah, it's very difficult. With microwaves anywhere near... The optimum wavelength is the microwave oven wavelength, And at that wavelength, you need such a big antenna that it's totally unwieldy, It's at least hundreds of meters across. And you can't move it quickly, So if someone wants to blow you up, they just send a missile. You can't get out of their way. So I don't really think it's the military thing is a serious argument against that. I mean, there are all sorts of issues to think about. But I don't think the weapon is one.
Are the people in Japan real interested in space and space development and tourism and economics in space? Is this a big topic for them?
It's not a big topic, but whenever something happens to do with space tourism, some news from the States or something. There's articles in the papers here and stuff. And we've got a little organization called the Society for Space Tourism of Japan. It's set up a few years ago by some travel agent guys. And they asked me to be the chairman, so I'm that. But some other guys, he basically do the running. And one of the members is the Japanese agent for Virgin. And he's got 20 customers who've paid up, and he's got several hundred on a list. And between us, we give speeches to schools and various events and stuff about space tourism. And everyone always really enjoys it. And whenever there's a bit of news about space tourism, the websites always get a jump, people looking on the web for space tourism and stuff. So I kind of suspect that it'll, once the first Japanese tourist goes over to the States, flies up to orbit, not orbit, just a suborbital flight and comes back, I think it's going to be like a paradigm shift. I mean, all of the news programs will cover him, and people say, hey, look, you can buy a ticket to space. So quite a lot of people know, the word is used much more, just like in the West now, space tourism. 20 years ago, no one even used the word, but now it's a well-known word. And when it actually starts to begin, I think it'll be a really big change here. I mean, I've spoken to quite a lot of people who know sort of business people in the space industry, and they say, well, once America does it, we'll probably do it too. But they don't have the sort of idea that we'll do it before America kind of thing, So that... I think the potential is good. And when I talk to schools and stuff, the kids or even students, they're all fascinated by it, One of the problems is they're just bored, I think. You know, a lot of young people, you know, their vision of what their job is going to be like is not very interesting. And, you know, they do these surveys of, you know, does your job allow you to fulfill your dreams? And they do this every few years. They did one the other day. It was the lowest ever score of young men working in, or young people working in companies. They're, you know, what percentage think it will allow them to achieve their dreams. And it's something like down to 30% or something, you know. And I think it's a social thing, and that there's a need for a certain amount of innovation and stuff. And there's a kind of a lack of it, you know. And a lot of them, you know, they know they'll start, once they start their job, they have this, you know, 40, 50, 60-hour week for the rest of their life kind of thing. And there's nothing kind of exciting on the horizon. Whereas if they say, hey, look, you know, the space open's going to happen. We'll be able to fly in the moon and stuff. I think the sort of vision of the future is very grim at the moment, you know, all this, and you know, with Korea and China and America nearby, Japan's, in those terms, it's quite a weak position, you know. They sort of, well, we'll probably be the battlefield between these superpowers or something. Yeah. Hey, no, there's a totally different world, you know, really open-ended, exciting new possibilities. I think that'll spread once people start flying, yeah.
Helen is in Kansas City with another email, and she said, is there a push in Japan for people to study the STEM subjects in college, which would be math and engineering and science, as there is here in the States?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not quite close enough to the education, the school education system, to know what exactly is going on in that field. But there's certainly a drift away from science, which they're a popular word for. Rika banare, they call it Rika banare. Rika is science and technology, and banare is leaving. So there's a Rika banare problem. And so governments, you know, the way governments do, after a while they recognize the problem, they say, hey, we have to do something about this. But it's very slow and laborious and so on. So I don't think they've got anything really effective yet. And when I give talks about space tourism, if I'm talking to, say, business people or politicians, I always say this. Quite apart from being a great fun industry, which I think we all want to do anyway, I'd say it's got a huge potential, as I was saying before, about reducing the need for aerospace weaponry building. You know, it's a substitute for that. But also, it'll revitalize the young people, you know. And there's a problem here called hikikomori, which is where children at some age, anywhere between about 16 and 30, suddenly going to throw up their hands and say, I can't bear this, and lock themselves in their room in their parents' house and won't come out. And they stay in there for about a year. I mean, they come out at night and steal food from their refrigerator. There's about a million people in this situation.
Jesus.
It's weird, isn't it? Yeah, but
yeah, it is.
I think it's part of this, you know. What is this? You know, what am I, you know, struggling hard, this boring job with no prospects or something, you know.
Here's another question.
But I think the STEM is an issue. It's certainly being discussed, but I haven't heard any good, you know, really sort of good solution. They've got a bunch of schools called Super Science High Schools, and I've given a talk to one of them.
Okay. Go ahead. I got another question.
Yeah, but there's nothing really exciting except space tourism.
You have a note from Bijan, who is in Sweden, and and so it's a two-part question. First part, one, what does the trade-off between more insulation in space than on Earth versus the cost of launching solar panels look like? Two, do you think that space solar power could start out in small scale with an orbiting solar power plant beaming power to satellites and the space station?
Thanks. Well, those are great questions about the whole SPS project. The trade-off is very simple. It all boils down to the launch cost. Today, it's absurdly too expensive. And simply speaking, you have to reduce the launch cost by about 99%, about 1% of where it is today. And normally you say, well, that's crazy, you can't do that. But you can, because launch vehicles are expendable. You know, if Boeing 777s only flew once, you know, it cost, $150 million just to get from America to Europe. But once you make them reusable and fly them 50,000 times, then the cost just comes right down and down and down. Having said that, that took 100 years to get that far down. But the trade-off depends on the launch cost. The key advantage over on the Earth is that it's continuous. You know, the solar sunlight in orbit is essentially continuous, whereas the solar panels on the Earth, we built all these millions of solar panels, and they're utilization ratio is hopeless. I mean, it's like 2 hours a day on average or something. So it's a much better deal to generate in space. Small scale, the key problem there is the usual idea for solar power satellites is you put them in stationary orbit. And that, as it happens, is 36,000 kilometers above the Earth. So you need a huge antenna in order to transmit a reasonably narrow beam down to the ground. And so if you're going to have a huge antenna, there's no point in just sending, let's say, 100 megawatts. You've got to spend 10 gigawatts to make it even barely worthwhile. So small scale is rather difficult. But delivering between satellites, it's being considered, and there are design studies for that. Nothing sort of convincingly better than each satellite having its own solar panels today, as I understand, anyway. So that it's pretty tricky to find a small step that in any way pays for itself towards SPS. Yeah.
So far it is still better, or at least equal, to have your own power supply rather than have one big satellite beaming power to a lot of different satellites.
Well, so far that's right. No one's found a sort of compelling argument. And I suppose it's because, you know, they have been building solar panels on satellites now for, quite a few decades. So it's a
right.
pretty straightforward business now.
And they've got them much better. I mean, they can take them out into deep, deep space now and still have power for a mission. So,
that's right.
So they're,
yeah.
they're getting a lot more efficient and a lot better with them.
Yeah. So once you see, if you're going to start bringing aluminium from the moon and then build great structures in orbit, and so you start needing gigawatts of power, well, then you don't necessarily want to be attached to a gigawatt solar panel, which is, you know, much bigger, you know, 20 square kilometers or something. So then beaming power for specific application over relatively short distances, I suspect, will become a much bigger part of the business, yeah.
So for commercial space, if you take solar power out of the equation, for at least for now in the foreseeable future, and you've still got space tourism, what other revenue generators do you see, or is space tourism it?
Well, I've found that my brain, it's what I call the default mode, is space tourism. You know, if I'm not doing anything else at all, I'm just, you know, wandering around, maybe walking towards a bus stop or something, I find I tend to be thinking about space tourism. And I think it's got so many things going for it. With the 75th anniversary this year, the first flight to space. And on that very day, the engineers drank a toast to space tourism, which, you know, we'll do once the war's over and stuff. It's just waiting there. And I must admit, I can't get excited about small satellites and stuff. You know, okay, they're fun for students and so on. But, you know, we're not going to build 50 million small satellites, whereas we could easily carry 50 million tourists. I mean, aviation carries 3 billion a year now, and it's still doubling every 10 years. It just grows and grows and grows. So yeah, I'm pretty focused on space tourism.
I'm trying to think if I can think of any other possible revenue generators. I think the small satellite market will reach saturation, and we'll start seeing some fallout. The barriers to entry are real little, real light, and it'll overpopulate, and I think there'll be a sort of a self-cleansing type of fallout in the industry.
Right. I think these lunar rovers that people are they due to fly this year? I think the little rovers on the moon.
But none of them have a ride. None of them have a ride that is going to go late this year to within the terms of the contest. So the contest is either going to terminate and there are going to be no winners, or they're going to have to renew and extend the contest for at least another year, maybe longer.
Uh-huh. What I was thinking is good about it is it's got a lot of people thinking about doing stuff on the moon, and you know, it's not that far away. It's not a million kilometers away. It's only 400,000, and you know, it's not that difficult in environment. You know, people talk about the harsh environment of space. Well, yeah, it is harsh compared to here, but you know, it's not like abominably harsh. And so I think that all helps people to see. You know, it's, you know, there's no reason not to do this kind of thing. You know, the barrier is not so big. But, of course, I don't think that'll be a big business itself.
Jack, and I have a caller on hold for you, but Jack is in Albuquerque, and he says your comments and thoughts on the economics of deep space mining and space resource usage.
Right. Well, What I really hope to see is that with some plans for big structures in orbit, in low orbit, like, say, space sports stadiums, and then we'll have competition to supply the aluminium and other minerals and so on, both from the lunar surface and from asteroids. And I've got friends on both sides of that, you know, and they say, we'll beat the others. And that would just be terrific, you know, the guys bringing in. And with the 3D printing, you have this brilliant thing of where you send out a bunch of satellites or people as well out to some asteroid. And as they bring it back in through one of the various ways which are kind of thought of, they'll be, you know, they'll be building structures as they come. And so they'll bring in already totally built, let's say, you know, sports stadiums straight into orbit. I mean, that's a terrific possibility, I think. And, you know, obviously the moon's much, much nearer. So, you know, it's sort of six of one and a half dozen. I think both of those sources are going to be great mining industries in the future, both asteroids, cometoids as well, you know, the remains of comets and stuff, with lots of gases and things like that, and the lunar.
Will they return the trillion-dollar asteroid to Earth like we hear and bring rare items back?
My mining friends tell me you'll never bring the whole asteroid back. You'll extract what you want there just because of the sheer mass, you know.
Right.
Obviously, it depends a little bit, but, you know, if you're getting nickel or aluminium or something, you'll extract it there and get a load up, you know, let's say a few thousand tons on your sort of bare-bones space vehicle. And as you come back in, you'll be making the alloys and the beams and the frames and maybe glass and stuff and building the structure. And even as you're coming in, it takes a few years, the whole project. People will be sending you new software into your 3D printing machines to make even more modern 3D printing machines and even more structures. I mean, it's a wonderful, you know, what's the virtuous circle of the potential you get in that. So I'm kind of pretty optimistic that will happen as well as lunar mining.
Let's see who your phone call's from. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please? Where are you?
It's Charles Lurio in Boston.
Hi, Charles. Go for it.
Yeah. Well,
hi, Charles.
It's been quite a while, Patrick. I wanted to say hello, first of all.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, it's quite a few years.
I had a call for that reason, if nothing else. But, you know, one of the, you mentioned earlier, work being, you know, places like NASA should be doing work on RLVs, R&D, and, you know, the problem is that the institutions have become so, I don't even know how to describe it, but let me just say that with regard to RLVs, someone in NASA told me the de facto rule is we will not do R&D on reusable vehicles because we tried that and it didn't work.
The space shuttle, you mean? The space shuttle didn't get any cheaper.
I mean, because they did it the wrong way several times. And now you literally cannot get R&D dollars.
Well, that's a good reason to quit, Charles. Can you think of a better reason to quit? It didn't work. I mean,
it didn't work because they won't admit that I don't think
space agencies should be the lead in this field. But I'm just frustrated that they have all this money, which is not spent on the most commercially promising activities. So, you know, even if President Trump was to take just a few hundred million from NASA and give it to the FAA and tell them, hey, we need some reusable vehicles, that would really help.
Patrick, they'd launch another investigation about him and he'd tell him he was shipping the money to Russia or something. I don't know. Charles, what else? They're not going to do RLV work, but what other things could they do?
Patrick said something about the, you know, business of, you know, how many satellites you could launch and, you know, how that would affect markets, perhaps. I mean, right now, the big thing coming up, and it's coming up rapidly, is this whole thing of creating a low orbit broadband system with several thousand satellites.
Uh-huh.
And you've got different companies doing that, and in particular, I was just reading testimony by one of the folks from SpaceX, which wants to start with 4,700 or 4,300 satellites and go add another 7,000 on top of that and launch them all with their own vehicle. The advantage being that they have the delay times are short, so they can compete with optical fiber, and they can reach places that optical fiber would be, there would be too much infrastructure cost.
I see. Yeah, right.
So that may not be millions of people going into space, but it may be a bridge to continuing to drive down the cost on these initial privately developed, reusable vehicles.
Right.
And
it's certainly, as you say, a sizable market. But my main sort of fear about that is if we have too many small satellites in orbit, they're going to bump into the hotels I want to see. It's the whole issue of sort of debris and collisions.
Well,
if they're free, they're going to get bigger and bigger because they get more fun if you have a bigger and bigger hotel, and that means that the potential for collisions gets bigger and bigger.
Well, these are probably going to be up around a minimum of 1,100 kilometers.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, that's well above. Okay, that's fine. No, I don't mind that.
I was just reading the document, so I didn't remember that. But anyway.
Right. Yeah, I think that the orbital facility is going to be at 350 and 400 kilometers because those are the convenient altitudes for going up and down. And I think the sports stadiums in the equator will be only at 300 because there'll be so many people going up and down that you'll be able to use tethers to boost them as the vehicles go back down again. So you can have them at a lower orbit.
Well, perhaps so. My point being is, I will take whatever market we can find right now because I think we are at the moment and we are getting far more activity in the private space arena than ever before. And,
right. No, that's absolutely right, yeah.
And so I think any rope that you can grab that will advance it from this point on, we need to grab it. And the companies are grabbing it, and a certain degree of finance people are grabbing it. I don't know if you saw the paper put out by Goldman Sachs beginning of April. And
oh, yeah.
It was actually a 98-page document. And this is not, I mean, what was amazing about the document was that it was saying stuff that when we said it 20, 25 years ago,
We were laughed out of the
lobby,
room.
Let alone, let alone the places with the smoke-filled rooms or whatever the equivalent is today. And,
yeah.
And yet you had these statements being made, statements like, the future of the Earth's economy is contingent upon the future of the space economy.
Is that right? In a Goldman Sachs report?
Yeah, you haven't seen that report yet, Patrick?
No, thanks very much. As you say, what very striking.
I'll make
for
sure
them to be saying stuff like that. Yeah,
I'll make sure you get a copy of it.
Yeah, it's available now online, but it's kind of a weird site.
It's tricky to download, but I'll make sure you get a copy of it, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
You'll really love it. It's
encouraging.
It's all charts and graphs. You'll love it.
Yeah, I read an interesting comment some time ago about the decision not to build a follow-on to the space shuttle, that it was, really divisive within NASA. But Buzz Aldrin and, he'd forgotten his name now, who the two guys who went to the moon first, Apollo 11.
Oh, Neil and Buzz.
Neil and Buzz. They fell out because Neil said, no, NASA has to build it. And Buzz said, if they do, it'll never get cheap. So however long it takes, you know, we have to leave it to the private sector. And I thought that was a really interesting, you know, kind of like a historic divide. And, you know, I go with Buzz, basically, that I think NASA could do much more to help than it is doing. But I agree with what you're saying, Charles, that it shouldn't be the one doing it, you know, in total, you know, like flying the passenger vehicle.
Right. Well, one of the other things that is, you know, is striking is that, I mean, you've got, fundamentally, you've got, on the largest scale, two companies driving things, and SpaceX at the moment, and let us all pray that they do not have any further accidents anytime soon. And then you've got Blue Origin, which Bezos is funding out of his pocket, and you know he sells $1 billion a year of Amazon stock, and he's building a semi-reusable orbital launcher.
I saw that, but he said recently he's going to spend $1 billion a year. Now that's getting to be serious money, isn't it?
Well, I mean, he just sold about $934 million worth of stock for his next increment.
Good work.
So, but the thing is, one of the key points that I thought was interesting in this testimony by this SpaceX person who was talking about the satellite constellation.
Oh, yeah.
About their own plans was that, you know, as a responsible company should, we're putting a large part of our profits into advancing the technology and iterating into new capabilities.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that was just not it for decades.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, at least not any capabilities that were practical. New capabilities that were practical. You had the people at the established aerospace companies, you know, waiting for their cost-plus contracts, whereas you have these folk coming down from Silicon Valley and saying, hey, you know, what we do is we plow the money back and we make even more money.
Yeah.
And we do that by creating new capabilities and expanding new capabilities.
It's great. It's classic innovation, isn't it? You know, that you bring in new blood from a totally different industry and their different way of thinking. It adds, you know, all sorts of new possibilities, which the traditional gang, you know, hadn't really got fully aware of or something. So,
very
promising.
Well, you know, we're not completely out of the woods yet, but we've made a lot of progress, and I can see that. Let's just say that there's a lot more to talk about.
Yes, indeed.
Every day.
And I guess another thing, the sort of information technology people, is that they've seen this giant progress just in their careers already, you know, and they're still quite young. And so they say, you know, progress is possible. You know, these old guys who say, oh, it's always been like this. You know, this is ripe for revolution, they probably feel, don't they?
Absolutely. So that's why, you know, it was driving, it's been driving some of the folks in the government nuts that you know they kept on modifying the Falcon 9, and they had a couple of problems a couple of times, but you know but iteration is, and then on a longer time scale, you know, coming up with something really new is the mother's milk of an industry that's thriving rather than just surviving or, you know, living off of the government teeth.
That's right. Oh. Yeah, no, I totally agree. Very well put. Yeah, that's right.
Charles, so, you got to wrap it up. I've got two more emails to read. You're done, right?
For now, so.
Okay.
Okay, thanks very much, Charles. Great to hear you.
Good to speak to you.
Thank you, Charles. Dr. Doug in Southern California says, Patrick, what about retirement? People spend more money retiring than on vacation. So I know from past conversations with Doug that he's talking about retirement centers or retirement homes on the moon or Mars.
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that it depends on people's situation, but retiring people usually have a lot of savings, you know, hopefully if their pension funds don't collapse. And one of the things that we talk about here a bit is that kids who want to go on their, you know, a suborbital flight will ask their grandparents to pay for them. it's a good question, yeah. It must be a market. I've you know, often thought about space tourism generally, all three phases of it, that it's ripe for market segmentation in the sense that, you know, young people want to go and do sports, you know, and compete in the Olympics, and older people maybe just want to go and look at the stars and contemplate the future and stuff like that, and then families with kids. And so that, yeah, the retirement potential is, it must be good. And again, if it had got cheaper, you know, the idea of having, as you say, retirement homes in orbit, I suspect would be very comfortable for people who like the, you know, zero-G situation. But and there have been stories about that in science fiction at least 20 years ago, maybe 30 or even 40 years ago. It's just never been done because it's never got cheap, isn't it?
Well,
so I think that's
I don't really see it. I disagree with Doug all the time on it. But you know, I have a friend, a very good friend, who is paralyzed from the waist down, and he was actually shot in a random shooting in San Francisco 30 years ago.
Wow.
And he's been in a chair ever since. But, you know, he could go into a microgravity or orbital situation, and he would not be bound to a wheelchair.
Oh, perfect. They say you don't need your legs in space. Yeah.
Well, that's
even flying is just your wings. It's just your arms.
That's
it'd be great, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Well, that's what they say.
The Paralympics is a big business these days.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of...
I mean, I don't know that they don't need their legs or not, but I don't know. Someone who does have mobility issues or something like that may find it very comfortable in a low-gravity environment, much more so than being stuck here on our gravity. I don't know the answer to that, but just a thought. I certainly would not be interested in retirement in space, but there may be people out there who would. Maybe they'll start another...
Yeah, maybe, exactly. Maybe not forever. A house in the country might be nicer for long term.
I don't know. Maybe we'll settle...
You have...
Listeners, I have Patrick back on the show, and he doesn't know what happened either. He did not get the $30 card message that I got. But we'll move on, and... Doug, I hope that when you go retire in space that, A, you have email so we can still stay in touch. B, they have regular mail so I can send you cards to your station from time to time, and you can do the same thing. Maybe we'll have mail delivery to and from your retirement center. Bijan had another question for you, Patrick. You still there?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I must ask you, as a professor in space economics, how you interpret the often published $330 billion figure as the yearly revenues of the so-called space industry. There are fewer than 1,000 satellites operating right now. Many of them are military, so that adds up to $1 million in revenue per satellite a day. Is space really that lucrative, or what does the $330 billion figure actually represent?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. And I'm not familiar with that particular figure, but I am familiar with these basically fake figures that get quoted, because the British government has often published figures for their space industry being something like $30 billion or something. And they include anyone who is watching TV through a satellite TV. So all of the programs and stuff that people watch via a satellite, they call space industry revenues. But this is ludicrous. It means the more British people sit around, you know, couch potatoes watching television, the better the space industry is. And it's completely fake. It's a bit like a company that has an Toshiba air conditioner, and Toshiba counts all the company's sales as Toshiba's revenues or something. So I suspect that figure is just the same. You know, anything, all of the business done through satellites is counted as space industry revenues. But, of course, a user doesn't care whether the telephone call is going through a fiber optic or through a satellite.
And I think it's very largely just space agencies trying to justify their huge income and not very significant contribution to economic growth. So I think if you dig into it, you'll find it's quite fake figures.
Okay, and listeners, we have one more phone call, and this is going to be it because we're at the two-hour point already. So, caller, who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling. Okay, we can barely hear you, Doug.
Oh, really? Can you hear me now?
Now we can hear you.
Okay. I'll be very brief because I know we're at the end of the show. I wanted to go ahead and reply to that question. And actually, I was listening. It looks like I got the answer, and that is it's actually not – the launch is a relatively small part of the overall revenue from space. It's actually the services provided through the satellites. That's where I believe the majority of space revenue comes from. And it is significant in that SpaceX, Elon with his – new company in Seattle to produce sort of mass manufacturing communication satellites in LEO.
Uh-huh.
Combined with reusability of the first stages of his Falcon 9 puts him in a highly competitive setting to establish low-cost constellation satellites, in which case it's not the launch revenue that he would be making his money from, but it's actually from the monthly sort of, dish network sort of revenue that people would be paying on a monthly basis. And that is far larger.
That's right.
The launch.
The launch cost is quite a small part, isn't it? I mean, a satellite would be $500 million or something, and a launch about $100 million. And the company gets enough money to pay back the $600 million for that. But they don't get, as it was just being said just now, they don't get enough to be paying hundreds of billions, do they?
So he did a filing, I forget who with, somebody in the government, and he estimated that with his constellation and the monthly revenues for services provided through his network of satellites, that he'd be generating about $20 billion per year, which is far greater than what he's generating through just launch.
Right. Yeah, they have a huge, much greater, because his launches, he's less than $100 million per launch, so that'd be right. But it's interesting, because if that giant network operates and it makes $20 billion revenues a year, that puts the figure from Bijan just now, $330 billion, it puts it into place. It can't be $330 billion today. It's more like $3 billion, I would think, probably any serious real revenues. Maybe a bit more, maybe $20
billion. Guys, don't they rent time on their transponders, and then the companies that have the transponders, they direct market a service to all of us watching DirecTV because they're selling their transponder time at a profit to send us the TV signal. So are they counting us here in our homes as part of that market, or are they counting the direct transponder user as part of that market? So I think that would make a big difference in the revenues that are being generated. Are you guys still there? Did I lose you both?
Yeah, that's right. As I said, the only ones I'd looked at in any detail was the British case, where they were counting all of the revenues of the television companies. I think it was to do with television broadcasting. And so all the revenues through the television
and try again.
As
you need help.
Space industry revenues, you see, which isn't right.
We lost Doug. So, Doug, if you want to get back to us real quick, go ahead, please. I don't know, but if you looked at all the satellite TV viewers around the world just who looked at soccer games, I mean, you'd have a huge revenue stream, but they're not really, I mean, they're getting their signal from space, but I wouldn't count them as part of the space industry. But the company,
the
company that has control of the transponder and is beaming that transponder down to the soccer game to all of those people, that is a company making its money in space. So I don't know, you know, if they're separating the final end user, which would be you and me, you know, in our homes, or if they're talking about who has control of the satellite transponders and is beaming that to whatever. So how they divide that revenue up. You know, if there's anyone out there with the space show who knows how this is priced and done with commercial satellites and DirecTV and things of that nature, I would really like to hear from you. And this would be an interesting space show program as to how these revenues are calculated and who's included in the revenue stream. And I'd be really interested in following up. So if anyone out there listening is in the satellite industry or the commercial industry and they know what the markets consist of and how it's done, please get a hold of me by email, and let's see if we can arrange to talk about it on air.
Yeah, it's a good topic to look into, because
absolutely,
it was being used, you know, sort of propaganda, saying, hey, look, we've got this great space station. The more British people spent time watching television, the better the space industry is. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely. So. Patrick, any closing comments, any thoughts you'd like to leave us until we get to visit again? Any pearls of wisdom?
I don't have pearls of wisdom. I've just enjoyed it very, very much. And I'd also like to say thank you to the, you mentioned the names of the sponsors, Orbital ATK, AIAA. I was very pleased that AIAA are supporting it, and Celestis. It's because, you know, you're doing such good work. The space show is really, I mean, this topic is really vital, and your introduction about, you know, that it's important for the whole of the offer, opportunities are really important. I totally agree with. And I think I probably asked you before, but did you interview Adriano Ortino of the Space Renaissance?
Yeah, years and years ago in Italy, and I haven't heard from him in a long, long time. But I think he was up again
because he's very active. I mean, you know, no money, but
that's the story with all of Space Renaissance
International SRI. You know, got a website and so on. But it's got like 90 members. Space organizations to members, so they sort of see that the central issue of reducing the cost of getting to space is really a very common theme of lots of different space organizations. And Adrianus, he's really eloquent, visionary guy. I'm very fond of him.
I probably still have his email address. I haven't heard from him in years, but I've done one show or maybe two shows with him. So I will see if I can reconnect. If I can't find his email address, I'll send you.
Let me know. I'll send you it. Yeah,
Or just send me the note.
His theme is so close to your theme that it'd be really, and there must be some synergy there, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Well, 16 years on the show, and you were the first guest, and here we are 16 years later. So I thank you very much for all your contribution and help that got me here.
And thank you also, and I look forward to discussing future successes, I hope.
I hope so, too. And so, listeners, that's it for today, and we do have our show tomorrow, and come back. Make sure you come back for that. No show on Sunday. It's Mother's Day here in America, and we don't do programs on Mother's Day or Father's Day. You all are supposed to spend time with your mother or your father or your family or something other than being a space cadet. And then back again on Monday. So everybody have a great week, and thank you for listening. Come back tomorrow morning and keep looking up. Goodbye from Dr. Patrick Collins in Japan, from myself and all of you who participated, and the space show.